Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. I have a very, very special guest. I've been on his show a little bit. He's been on mine, but it's been a little while because I save him for very special occasions, and that is Ken Milne. And if you somehow have been living under a rock when you get to podcasts or emergency medicine in general, or you just somehow haven't been to a conference where he is at, Ken Milne is the star, the guest, the special guy who does so many different things, but most especially The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, his blog and podcast that is filled with all sorts of foamy goodness. And I love Ken's style because he focuses on one paper at a time and goes into the nitty-gritty of it, talks about all these little things, talks nerdy to you, and cuts that KT window down to less than 1 year in many cases, or sometimes even less than 1 month with his SGM hop. But I'm stealing so much thunder away from Ken. Ken, what can we add as far as all of your greatness?
Maybe some humility. Thank you very much for the very kind introduction. I got two varies. Maybe it's just one vary for every 50 total EM podcasts.
I like that, but I will run out of varies and I'll sound like other people who use vary too much because, you know, that's all they know, like Bigly. Oops, sorry, did I include that in there? So I have you on because we have kind of a standing agreement that for each one of these podcasts. Now, you can come on more than often than this, Ken, but just, you know, you're here for the 50th, you talked about being on the 100th, and we'll just have to see how it keeps going on. But hopefully, at least every 50 podcasts, we can have you, because in many ways, you are the original mentor for me as far as doing the podcasting, getting this out there, figuring out when I have kinks, when I have issues, I come to you, because yeah, I so much appreciate all the help that you have given me along the way. You are truly a mentor and I really appreciate it. And I've turned around and given some of that same knowledge that you've given to me as far as how to do podcasting and how to handle the many situations that come up, and have given it to other people out there. Because fortunately, I am no longer the only emergency medicine PA out there doing a podcast, or a PA in general. We've got other great people doing podcasts as well. And, you know, they have their blog sites and everything like that. So I've been really trying to help out with that too. And I really appreciate you, Ken, doing all that to make that possible for me. And so I'm so happy to have you on for the special 100th podcast.
And it is so great to see you hit triple digits, 100. And this is one of the great things about the FOMED world is that it's really made it a horizontal strata. You know, everybody's usually willing to help out each other. And I certainly didn't get to where I am on my own. I had people that helped me out that I reached out to, and I've paid it forward to you, and you're paying it forward to someone else. So I think it's just a really great meta circle of life, whatever you want to call it. But it's nice to see that you're hitting the triple digits, 100.
And I am so excited about that, because we are going to talk about some different things that we've been tying into recent podcasts, but just overarching themes, because at least on my podcast, we kind of bump around and mess around with the themes and how we're going to do things. But with you, Ken, we had to do something special. And I wanted to combine things that you've covered on your show and I've covered on my show, and kind of really do a nice little summary about how EM got ahead of the evidence, or just medicine in general got ahead of the evidence, and how we need to be skeptical, which is everything you're about. You're all about being skeptical with everything you hear, even if you've heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. See, I got your tagline in there.
I saw how you did that. I saw that. You know what else is nice is that we're usually talking about cutting the knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year. But we're going to talk about five examples where the literature, people started practicing things before they had reasonable support from the literature. So basically, five examples of when EM, at least the practice of it, got ahead of the evidence to emphasize why we need to be skeptical. So there's that Goldilocks zone, right? We don't want to be Luddites and waiting, you know, over 10 years to start implementing high quality, clinically relevant information. But we also don't want to jump on the bandwagon too quickly when we really don't have the support to be doing what they're suggesting.
So to tie this all in, because in true Ken fashion, we have to do it this way. We have five, that's right, five things to talk about as far as examples go. And I noticed, Ken, you kind of snuck in a little more than five, but we're combining it all into one, which is sepsis. I get ahead of myself because we're going to save the best for last there because there's so many great little pearls in there. But the five things we're going to talk about are thrombolysis for acute CVA, CT scanners and ambulances, mechanical CPR, therapeutic hypothermia, and then yes, of course, sepsis. So Ken, are you ready to get to dive in on these details and see about what we can hash out with all the evidence that we've got, or maybe lack thereof?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. And thanks for noticing that I was able to combine a few things to make it more than five, but still stick to that sort of theme of five things. God forbid I lose a finger and can only count to four.
No, no, we can't have that happen, but at least you have your toes still, hopefully, to count up to five that way. All right, so the first thing, let's talk about thrombolysis for acute CVA. So everyone knows in emergency medicine about TPA, and obviously there's been a lot of controversy there. But Ken, I mean, let's talk about this. What's the real research behind using, and we're going to talk about TPA specifically, because that's where a lot of the research and the guidelines are at right now, is about specifically using TPA. Of course, we can talk about thrombolytics in general, but what research is there, or maybe lack thereof, in kind of a brief form, about treating it with acute CVA?
Well, I do like to frame it with talking about thrombolysis for acute CVA, because even though some of the trials, and one in particular we're going to talk about, involve TPA, the evidence doesn't show that it really matters which thrombolytic was used, but we'll get past that. The world changed in 1995 in the world of emergency medicine, and that's when the NINS studies came out. There was part one and part two for the NINS study, and this was after a few previous studies that didn't really show benefit for thrombolysis for acute CVA, and then along came NINS part one and two. Like I said, the world changed. Now, part one of NINS was looking at whether or not there was an improvement in patients presenting with acute stroke within 24 hours. And the result was it didn't demonstrate that. But part two looked at a few indexes, and particularly they were looking at 90 days, and they did find a statistical significant difference or improvement if you were in the treatment group. Now, there were lots of problems with NINS, and I'm not going to rehash them all here, but ever since then, everybody said, wow, we've got a study that shows benefit. Wow, let's just roll this out and start doing this. And this is one of those examples where I think the practice of emergency medicine got ahead of the literature, because if you look at the totality of the literature, back when I reviewed this study with Anand Swaminathan, there was 12-ish major trials looking at thrombolytics and stroke, and two of the trials showed benefit. The one we just mentioned, that was NINS Part 2 with about 300-plus patients, showing about a 12% benefit if TPA was administered within 3 hours. And then there was the ECAS-3 study that was between 3 and 4.5 hours. And again, it showed benefit a little bit less, about half the amount in relative terms, about 7% in absolute benefit. But both studies showed an increase in intracranial hemorrhage. But there were six other studies that did not show a primary benefit and showed harm. And then four studies that were stopped early due to harm or stopped early due to unlikely to provide a benefit. And so at the end of the day, you've got 12 studies with only one in each time category showing benefit, and the rest of them either neutral or negative. And yet here we are, 2018, and we've got stroke centers of excellence.
Yeah. And so as this will tie in with the next subject here in just a moment, but when we are using this, it has caused a lot of issues because guidelines are starting to add their weight as far as what they want to do. So, for example, ASEP has guidelines on this. One thing I do appreciate with ASEP that is different from some other organizations and their recommendations is that it's all about suggestion of could or consider or things like that. That little change in verbiage to allow the clinician to actually make the ultimate decision versus saying you have to do thrombolysis on strokes, because a lot of patients don't qualify, or maybe really after you have a good discussion with them, or at least with their family, they decide that maybe we shouldn't do this after all. And then informed consent for something that's not a proven type of treatment is something that we need to seriously consider no matter what we're talking about. But specifically with everything that's come out with stroke care, this is something that we have to have a more detailed discussion on.
Well, you did mention ASAP, and ASAP actually changed the recommendation. Prior recommendation did have it as a much higher recommendation. It was an A recommendation that TPA should be offered to all patients who qualify in less than 3-hour window. And there was a general uprise within the grassroots to challenge that because, you know, that level of evidence usually comes from multiple randomized control trials or a systematic review of high quality studies. And it really wasn't that strong. Like the evidence wasn't that strong to make that kind of recommendation. And so actually I was, you know, happy that ASAP actually pulled back from that. And that's the recommendation that you were starting to refer to, where they got into more maybe or could be or those types of qualifiers. So to give the clinician some wiggle room to interpret the data and see how they could treat their patients best.
Which I think ties in nicely to the next thing, which has even less evidence in many ways to support it, and that is putting CT scanners in ambulances. So let's talk about that real quick in the time is brain fallacy.
Yeah, so I don't know how long you want to have your brain cut off from, you know, blood, oxygen, and sugar, but me personally, I don't want it to be very long. But there is this thought that, you know, time is brain. And while I get that conceptually on the very short-term basis, on a long-term basis, I don't see that as well. And what's really, I think, more important is there salvageable? Is there a penumbrum that is salvageable that can be reperfused that will get better? And CT scanners, at least non-contrast CT scanners, when they're being done, they're looking for is the patient bleeding or not? That's what they're looking for. And this idea that we've got to get it as quick as possible and time is brain. After a certain point in time, I think that sort of falls apart unless you can show that you've got some salvageable areas of brain to reperfuse. And so what the stroke sort of proponents have done is pushed diagnostic imaging into the pre-hospital setting to see if we could get that time down and improve. And so a number of studies have been done to do that. I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4-ish studies looking at that and putting CT scanners in ambulances, having them out there and cutting down that time. And while they are able to show a statistical difference in time to TPA decision or time to TPA delivery, those types of things, they haven't looked at or demonstrated an improved patient-oriented outcome. In other words, spending all this money, because I believe it costs about $1 million for one of these ambulances and then another $1 million a year to operate, did it translate into a patient-oriented benefit? And that's what we want to see. Right, we want to treat our patients and have them doing better on something that they would consider important. Not, oh, look, you got it to me 40 minutes earlier. I'm still just as bad as I would have been, but you got it to me earlier. And that really doesn't make a difference for them clinically.
And it's important to consider the cost. I mean, briefly, you mentioned it, Ken, but the cost behind this is substantial. When you're talking about an ambulance that costs roughly about $1 million, and on a previous podcast, we talked more about the details of this, but when you talk about an ambulance that costs about $1 million just to buy, and then about $1 million a year to staff, and that's to have the full crews that you need. Unfortunately, a lot of places can't maintain those types of costs, so they cut corners. And one of the biggest corners we're cutting is having the stroke neurologist on the ambulance, which you may not think is a big deal, but when you have to now take the CD or however you're going to transfer the data to get to a radiologist to then read it, you've lost the time window that you're trying to cut down in the first place. Because the idea was to have someone right there, read it, interpret it, say, yes, this patient is appropriate or not. All of a sudden, the whole thing behind this no longer actually works. And then you've got the additional costs of considering that if it costs $1 million a year, how many people do you have to treat that would not otherwise have to be treated? Because that's the biggest thing to consider. If they're going to get TPA either way, whether or not it's beneficial, like I said, is controversial. But let's say that we've discussed the controversy. We understand that. How many more people do we have to treat a year? That's about 100 people a year to be financially sustainable. And that cost alone, the population that we need to do that is at least 4 million per ambulance. And realistically, most of these centers don't have those type of numbers to hash out. And that's assuming a best case scenario on that. So all these numbers combined are things that really play a pivotal role in deciding, is this appropriate or should we be spending those millions of dollars onto other parts of stroke care that have a benefit, such as better rehabilitation or better understanding or better research behind other alternatives. So those types of things all come into play as well.
Now, I look at it slightly different because I'm coming out of a healthcare system and we don't have for-profit centers and things like that. So when you're spending money, it's coming from a fixed amount, let's say, or where are we going to micro-allocate our scarce resources? So I understand the idea of, oh, well, you know, how many millions of dollars to save one life or to have a neurologic improvement. But remember, when you look at the, you have to start with, A, I believe the data. In other words, the data is strong enough to support giving TPA or thrombolysis, but TPA for acute CVA. I remain skeptical. And then compound that with, okay, you're going to give it. Now you have to believe or agree with or accept the data that time is brain and that the time that we're talking about will make a difference. And typically in these studies, only single digit percentages of people qualify for the TPA for CVA under 3 hours. And then of those people, remember, not everybody gets better. It shows an improvement. It's not an NNT of one. The number needed to treat is actually much higher. Only about 12 to 13% have an improvement on a modified Rankin scale at 90 days. And we know that there's an absolute harm of about 6% are going to have intracranial hemorrhages. So we're not even there yet. And yet they're rolling out these ambulances. Why not? And I know you refer to improving stroke. So every specialist thinks that their area is really, really important. But as providing emergency care, we take everything, anywhere, anytime, anybody coming in. And so how do we spread that out to the population? And how do we micro allocate that scarce resource? And so if you have got $1 million to purchase and $1 million a year to run, could you give me the $1 million and maybe I will buy 5 ambulances and staff 5 more ambulances and I will drop my time response times from 15 minutes to 8 minutes, where we know that response times when it comes to cardiac arrest, time to defibrillation, that saves lives. Or you could even get bigger and step back and say, what about if we spent that money on social determinants of health and access to nutritious foods, good jobs, better education? Would that be dollars better spent? I don't have the answers for that. I'm not saying that I do, but I think that's a society's question when looking at, should we be doing this or should we put it into things that we know can make a difference and have an impact?
So I love how you tie this all in, because that is all about the patient-oriented outcomes, not only for stroke care, but for all sorts of care, including cardiac arrest. And I like how you mentioned that, because you got that all in there, the cardiac arrest, the patient-oriented outcomes, all that kind of stuff, tying to our third example of when EM got ahead of the evidence. And that is mechanical CPR. Talk about that, Ken.
Sure. So, you know, there's been a number of different device companies that have come up over the last few years and done research and published over the last few years of using a mechanical CPR device. So sometimes they're piston devices pushing down on the chest, and sometimes they're a squeezing sort of elastic sort of band around the chest. And that sort of comes from the idea that AHA says we need high quality, uninterrupted CPR for good outcome. But it has to be a bridge to somewhere. So it has to be somebody who's salvageable. And so they did a number of these studies, and sure, you could show that, you know, that there wasn't as many interruptions and that there was a constant rate with these devices. But there was a systematic review and meta-analysis done in 2015 and published in Resuscitation. And that was by Gates et al. And looking at the systematic review of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with these devices, and again, focusing in on patient-oriented outcome like, am I alive or dead? You know, you're not only mostly dead. Well, I guess you could be mostly dead if you don't have good neurologic outcome. But they didn't show any benefit with ROSCE, return of spontaneous circulation, survival of the event, survival to discharge at 30 days, or the key one, survival with good neurologic outcome. And this was out of 5 RCTs, randomized control trials, with over 10,000 patients showing no superiority with mechanical CPR devices. So, of course, our local ambulance provider bought one.
Well, and so this is actually, and not to disagree with Kim, because the evidence is there and the evidence shows it, but I think, as you mentioned, it's got to be a bridge to somewhere. And that's probably the issue with mechanical CPR versus regular manual compressions, is there is a little difference there. And there is a little bit of difference in the actual application of it. But that becomes a really challenging bit. How do you use something that is not directly tied into basically proven medicine? And so for me, you know, a lot of our ambulances and a lot of our agencies and a lot of our hospitals don't use mechanical CPR because of lack of the evidence. But when you're talking about a limited environment or transportation or stuff like that, maybe you're not going to get patient-oriented outcomes, but maybe it can benefit by keeping people, fewer people in the resuscitation or in a resource-limited environment like the pre-hospital setting, especially where now you have to transport someone who may be in arrest for maybe certain reasons like refractory VFib and they need PCI or however that's going to be done. That patient needs to be safely transported. And by having, and I've done this, standing compressions in the back of the ambulance, it's a little bit of a scary experience each time because it's not very safe. It's not very stable. Whether or not it translates directly to patient-oriented outcomes becomes a little more of a controversy. And as Ken just discussed with the recent literature, okay, we don't have a direct patient-oriented outcome for that specific cause, but maybe it still serves a role. But that difference is something we need to acknowledge because right now with the current evidence, we don't have that. But maybe there's still a role. We just need to better define what that role is versus a all-comer approach like we currently have.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties I have is when I see these reports and a to refer back to, we're the first hospital to have 2 or 3 ambulances with CT scanners in it. In my resource limited environment, it was, we are now in our ambulances having a mechanical CPR device and it's going to save lives. And I'm like, well, wait, where does that come from? But if you're going to employ something, first of all, don't make claims that you can't back up. And the second thing is, if you have a hypothesis that this could be safer for the paramedic crews, absolutely, that's an important thing. The safety of our healthcare providers is absolutely important. Great, study it before you actually go out and purchase it and do it. Because maybe some kind of harnessing device or seatbelt device or something, because I work in a resource-limited environment. I've done CPR in the back of the ambulance for over 20 years doing transports. It can be scary and difficult and challenging and risky, but is some kind of restraining device cheaper and better than having a mechanical device? The answer is, I don't know. At least that's the honest answer. So until we do know, until we've properly investigated it, again, this is another example of where we're getting ahead of the evidence. And I hear what you're saying. And I think I've made the comment before that, if you've got a prolonged arrest and you're doing CPR for a long time, it has to be a bridge to somewhere. And how many people can have CPR done for a prolonged period of time and have a good neurologic outcome? It's got to be rare.
Well, maybe we just need to do therapeutic hypothermia at the same time. Oh, wait, That's the next topic.
Oh, wait. You are going to become the master of segues.
I'm working on it. So let's talk about this therapeutic hypothermia and the evidence or lack there. Now, in Canada, though, we can just throw them in the back of the ambulance like usual, right? Because it's just so cold up there all the time.
You know, every time an American makes a joke and hurts my feelings, I just go to the hospital and get them checked for free.
Oh, is that a burn?
Burn. That's a Canadian burn. No. So, we do arrive, maybe with a little bit lower temperature due to the outside ambient temperature. But this idea of cooling people for a therapeutic reason for out of hospital cardiac arrest really jumped into our practice back in the early 2000s. There was a couple of small trials published. One had almost 300 patients and one had under 100 patients. And they were both in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. But if you looked at the numbers, they were too good to be true. And this is sort of a take-home message here, people. If you see a result and you go, survival from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, survival with good neurologic outcome improved from 26% to 49%, 23% number needed to treat of like 3 or 4. I think that's too good to be true. But unfortunately, people jumped on board and got a little bit ahead of the evidence, and we started seeing cooling centers of excellence. But then some better studies, some bigger studies, some studies involving 1,000+ patients were done. And I'm thinking of the one done by Kim et al. About 10 years later in 2013. And when they randomized people with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest into cooling and not cooling, again, there was no improvement in the patient-oriented outcome. And so the evidence didn't support the practice, and the practice got ahead of the evidence.
This is interesting to talk about specifically because even though maybe bringing the temperatures down low doesn't make as big of a difference as we initially thought it does, maybe, and this is something I'd love to get your feedback on, maybe the important thing is not about lowering the temperature, but about avoiding the hyperthermia, the getting the temperature too high, because that has some evidence that it can cause neurological harm. So maybe the goal is targeted temperature management, TTM, to keep the temperature around 36, try and avoid it getting hyperthermic, essentially.
Yeah, and that's the Nielsen study that was in New England Journal comparing 33 degrees Celsius versus 36 degrees Celsius. And sorry, I can't convert that to Fahrenheit. And they had about 1,000 patients in that study. And again, this did not, some people interpreted that showing that therapeutic hypothermia did not work. And I think that that was slightly incorrect interpretation. I think a more correct interpretation was there was no difference based on this study between 33 and 36. So 36 would be just as good as 33, and 33 would be just as good as 36 with regards to mortality at the end of the trial, which was the primary outcome. But I agree with you. I think we should just be preventing people from getting hyperthermic. And they've done some stuff since then showing that when people got a little bit more relaxed or loosey-goosey, I guess, with letting people's temperature go up, they weren't as focused on making sure that they didn't get hyperthermic and ran into a few problems. So I think that the idea of not letting people get hyperthermic is a reasonable idea, but I don't think we need to drive them down to 32 or 33 degrees Celsius with some fancy device to do that.
So maybe what we need instead is some early goal-directed therapy. Okay, I'm pushing the segues a little bit, but I'm trying to get us to sepsis.
The big meaty thing at the end of this 100th episode.
Yes, sepsis is one of the things that I think everyone at this point in emergency medicine knows. And we've talked about it. You've talked about it a lot. I mean, it's one of those things that people know what sepsis is now better than what we have a long time ago. But realistically, how much do we actually know about sepsis? I mean, maybe Bat Doc knows a little more about sepsis than all of us, but to the everyday person who's treating an emergency medicine, there's a lot of things that we're still trying to figure out. And because of the KT window, that knowledge translation window, we're having a lot of issues about keeping up with the sepsis research. So let's talk about the first thing, because it's ultimately what led us to change how we manage septic patients, and that's early goal-directed therapy. Do we still need to do all the different things like measuring CVP?
So the early goal-directed therapy came out by Manny Rivers, or Emmanuel Rivers, and he really, you know, deserves some credit for focusing our attention on a critically, critically important thing that we see in the emergency department. And sepsis had a mortality rate in that original study up in the high 40s, I think, 40-something percent. And by doing early goal-directed therapy, he was able to get that mortality rate down significantly. But it came as a bundle. You couldn't take it a la carte. You had to do the whole bundle of things. But then about 2 years ago, there was this trifecta. There was three international studies with about 1,000 patients in each that really challenged whether or not we needed to do the complete bundle or not. And so that was PROCESS, PROMISE, and ARISE. And those three studies didn't demonstrate a superiority to early goal-directed therapy versus the usual care. But we have to acknowledge that because of the Manny Rivers study, usual care really stepped up their game. And so I think that a lot of what we've done in sepsis, and I appreciate you giving me credit. I don't think I'm any smarter than anybody else when it comes to sepsis. And I think sepsis, one of the reasons it's difficult and challenging is, first, it can be occult, so hard to recognize, but it's also a spectrum. And it's a lot of different diseases that end up in a same common pathway at the end with, you know, severe sepsis, septic shock, end organ failure. But that process to get there can come from so many different sources, and the patients that have it can be so different that we're looking at such a heterogeneous population that it's really challenging. But they showed that, you know, if you just actually pay attention, provide some fluids, get that antibiotic on board quickly when you recognize it, give it, and then follow the patients along and be conscientious and be, you know, pay attention to these people, they do well. And you don't need to go with all the invasive testing and, you know, fine tuning to get the mean arterial pressure this way or that way. That kind of precision, I really don't think we have the information. And I don't know if we will because of the heterogeneous population that we're trying to treat.
So then we can just fix them with steroids, right?
Exactly. Just throw some steroids, because we know, again, the evidence isn't great, but we throw steroids at everything. If it's inflammation, just give them steroids. And unfortunately, the steroid issue on sepsis is pretty mixed. There was a couple of papers published looking at it, and then a study came out recently called Hypris. And Hypris really didn't show any statistical difference with regards to their primary outcome when they were looking for, you know, development of septic shock within 14 days in that Hypris study where they were giving steroids to patients to prevent them from going down that pathway. But when you looked at their secondary outcomes, and of course, secondary outcomes are typically hypothesis generating, they looked at all the mortality times at 28 days, 90 days, 100. There wasn't any difference in mortality either. So there wasn't even a signal there to suggest we should look into that further. So unfortunately, again, it's a complicated disease, a complicated illness, and wouldn't it be great if there was a real, this is me doing a segue, wouldn't it be great if there was a really simple thing, even simpler and cheaper than just giving every septic patient steroids to save lives?
You're talking about vitamin C, right?
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. I can't let you get away with all the segues. I know what's coming up. you know, wouldn't that be fantastic if we could just give people vitamin C? Now, of course, this stirred up a whole bunch of stuff about a year ago. And this was not just vitamin C, to be clear. It was a vitamin C cocktail that included hydrocortisone and thiamine for the treatment of severe sepsis and septic shock. And this was by one of the really well-known individuals in the sepsis research and ICU field, and that's Dr. Paul Merrick. And he published an observational study of, I think it was about 50 patients And it was a before and after study. So what they did was they looked at about 50 patients before they started this vitamin C protocol and about 50 patients after. And just like I said, remember when I said in 2002, there was a couple of studies that showed really amazing outcomes at, you know, centers where for hypothermia, for therapeutic hypothermia. And it's like, that's really amazing. I think that might be too good to be true. Well, they showed a mortality decrease from 40% down to under 10% with this vitamin C cocktail, which is, wow, really strong hypothesis generating results. But it really does tickle my, that sounds too good to be true, buttons.
Well, and we've talked about this. Actually, you invited me to come onto your podcast specifically, along with a lot of other people, to give our input on some of the key issues that come up with research like this. Because it's great that we've had people like Paul Merrick and Manny Rivers and all these other experts in the field to do this research. We're not saying that there's not important things to investigate here, but rather we're maybe jumping the gun a little bit too soon. And I think that's the important thing we need to put in there. It's not that we're trying to say this will never work or that we are saying we can't do this type of research or stuff like that, but we need to be skeptical before implementation, just like any of the stuff we've talked about today.
Absolutely. And this is, again, another example of where the practice got ahead of the literature. And we're not talking about denialism. There's a difference between healthy skepticism and denialism. Denialism is like, nope, nothing works. You know, it's just nihilism, not just denialism. It's nihilism. But skepticism is a scientific skepticism. A healthy skepticism is like, oh, that's interesting. Well, the burden of proof is on you. Show me. And if you show me good enough evidence, I'll believe you. And there was a really important reason, Chip, that I brought you on the show to discuss that with about a dozen other people about that Paul Merrick study. And that was one of the reasons I was so thrilled that you asked me to help you out with Total EM. And that's, you know, emergency medicine, great care depends on people in the pre-hospital setting, in the hospital, in a team environment. That means PAs, NPs, MDs, RNs, physio, you know, you name it. Anybody who's have direct or indirect care of critically ill patients need to be involved, to the ICU, to the inpatient ward, to the discharge and follow-up with primary care. Patients deserve the best care based on the best evidence. And we don't want to be denialists. We don't want to be nihilists, but we also want to be team players. But I'm encouraging skepticism. And when it came to this last thing that we're just talking about, the vitamin C, again, I would be really, really happy if this turns out to be true. But having an observational before and after study isn't enough to change my practice. But a lot of other places seem to have jumped on board and said, yep, let's do it. Yet we don't have good evidence. And time again, well, we've given you a number of examples today where the practice got ahead of the evidence. And I really think we need to think about it, be skeptical of it. And I'm all about cutting that KT window down. But that KT window down, that goal is to take high quality, clinically relevant information, not low quality, preliminary, not replicated, not validated evidence, and start doing it.
Okay. I think I've got this all figured out, Ken. So early goal-directed therapy is out. Vitamin C and sepsis, too soon. Steroids for sepsis, also too soon. So we just need to treat patients faster. Everyone who comes in needs IV antibiotics as soon as possible. Is that right?
According to the new guidelines that have been proposed, they want people to get antibiotics and 30 cc's per kilogram within the first hour of being triaged. And I think that that is going to cause more harm than benefit, because we want to be good and fast, but we don't want to just be fast and indiscriminate. And if we're indiscriminate, like has been at least how I'm interpreting it, to be indiscriminate, to say, listen, if we suspect you have sepsis, you're getting 30 cc's per kilogram and you're getting, IV antibiotics within the first hour. And it's taking away some of my clinical judgment, not recognizing that this takes place in a context in a very busy emergency department. And the fact that, you know, we do not have a good tool to screen people and identify them faithfully or reliably to say, yes, you do have sepsis or you don't have sepsis. We don't have that tool. And so, you know, you can easily see a teenager or early 20s individual, young man with a sore throat coming in with a fever, strep throat, and a heart rate of 95 to 100. And it's like, uh-oh, we've got to give him 30 cc's per kilogram and IV antibiotics. And it's concerning that these things will then be turned into metrics to judge our quality of care and say, well, you're not giving quality care unless you're doing all of these things. And we're going to put pay for performance potentially in there. We've been down this road before. We need to be cautious and skeptical about how we apply the literature and make sure that we have really good evidence before we start saying, thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that, and we are going to measure you and pay you accordingly.
And I think what you're alluding to is the pneumonia treatment, whereas the four-hour guidelines and everything like that.
Well, I lived through that period. Now, we didn't have that here in Canada, but certainly with all my colleagues down in the U.S., you know, they were talking about putting antibiotics out in triage in a little candy bowl to make sure that they reach that metric and, you know, that we're just going to be causing a swath of harm compared to the potential benefit by doing that. We need to get the diagnosis right. And, you know, sometimes that takes a little bit of time to do that. And as soon as we recognize an infectious process, sure, I understand. Let's get the antibiotics on board. I'm not saying let's wait, but let's get it right. And let's not put these artificial metrics in there to try to push that. And you're going to push that balance or that pendulum or that teeter-totter towards harm.
It's important to mention here real quick for the people who haven't been listening to the other podcasts, especially from other people as well, because we've talked about this on our own stuff. The Surviving Sepsis Campaign and this one-hour guideline, it's not just as easy as it sounds. It's not from the point of recognition, which is where other previous guidelines have gone with the 3 to 6 hours and stuff like that. We're talking about specifically from the time that that person checks in and triage. And if you work in a busy emergency department, or even if it's not that busy, it's just sometimes it gets busier than others. 1 hour to identification is very, very complex and very time consuming, and actually something that realistically is probably going to cause a lot more harm than good. And that's the thing that we're talking about here, which is why people like Scott Weingart and the rest of us who are backing this up have helped form a petition, or at least supporting a petition, that we need to seriously reevaluate this. Can you talk about the petition, Ken?
Yeah, so this was put forward by a number of individuals about the Surviving Sepsis 2018 guidelines, where they specifically recommend the initiation of antibiotics and 30 cc's per kilogram within 60 minutes of the emergency department triage, not within the time that you recognize it or through the system. The clock starts ticking when you walk in. And, you know, the concern is that this is going to cause more harm than potential benefit. And think about it, you know, like if everything is becoming an alert, how do you separate the fly shit from the pepper? But if everybody is like this, okay, we're going to have a code stroke, we've got to have a code STEMI, we've got to have a code sepsis, we got to have, you know, triage becomes irrelevant and clinical judgment becomes irrelevant. So we really need to think about these things before we implement them to make sure that there will be a net benefit.
Okay, so now I'm lost. So basically, nothing works in emergency medicine. We just need to throw everything away. The literature is useless.
You're a nihilist now. No, of course not. And you know what? We should all have an NNT of one, because you know what works? Kindness. And it starts with kindness. And just be kind when you're on shift and be nice to people. That's a good starting point. You can have an NNT of one, because every single patient that comes to the emergency department, we have an opportunity to help. But we have good evidence for certain things. But we have to recognize that a lot of the stuff we do, we're standing on pillars of salt and sand. And we shouldn't get too self-righteous about our beliefs or our, that this is going to work or that's not going to work. We need to recognize and pull back and say, what you do matters. Absolutely. How you do matters, because people will remember how you made them feel. So make them feel valued. But also, we do not have a huge amount of great evidence, which means there's lots of opportunity still to do research. But we don't have a lot of great evidence to say we have low numbers needed to treat for benefit. and we systematically underreport harm. So just know that going in and have some healthy skepticism and go, really, I wonder what the primary literature says about aspirin and STEMI, or oxygen and STEMI, or nitroglycerin and STEMI, or morphine and STEMI. Oh, wow, I just went through the Mona. The Mona. It sounds like we'll have a show at 150, I think.
Yes, we're going to have to. But to recap today, so we make sure we get everything. Thrombolysis for acute CVA, we need better research. And we've had a lot of negative studies compared to the few positive studies, which should keep us skeptical for that reason. CT scanners and ambulances, a lot of cost, again, without really the evidence to back it up. In fact, very limited evidence that shows whether or not it's effective, and most of it is not related to patient-oriented outcomes, which ties in with mechanical CPR, which, again, doesn't have patient-oriented outcomes of survival, but maybe there's still a benefit with it. We still have to do that kind of research to see if that's really what we need to be using appropriately. And then therapeutic hypothermia, something that we all use. Maybe in Canada, it's a little easier than down here in the US where it's hot right now. And what we need to instead consider is, do we just need to avoid hyperthermia? And then finally, sepsis. Oh, so many things to talk about sepsis. But essentially, we are making advances. It's just not the advances we always are getting thinking are going to be what makes the difference. It's the stuff that we have to get into the details, just like the rest of it. Did I summarize that okay there, Ken?
Yeah, you did a good job. I would say for thrombolysis and stroke, I remain skeptical. For therapeutic hypothermia, my conclusion to that would be, don't let them get hot. Mechanical CPR, we should have good evidence of benefit, not just for the patient, but I guess for the provider before we start implementing and purchasing these expensive devices. And then what did we get into after that? We got into, was it sepsis?
I think it was sepsis, yeah.
When it comes to sepsis, it's complicated, it's difficult, but it's early recognition, some fluids, broad spectrum antibiotics, source control, monitoring them. I'm skeptical about steroids, and I'm skeptical about vitamin C protocols. I will change my mind as a good skeptic. I will change my mind when presented with better evidence that I should change my mind. And then the last thing is, let's not have these guidelines or metrics or things pushing our care when we don't have good evidence that that should be done and there might be net harm.
Ken, as always, it is a pure pleasure to have you on, and I am so glad that we got to do this again for the 100th podcast. I'm just so excited. I keep saying that over and over again, but this is great. I enjoy talking about this, and I feel like there are so many things about medicine that we need to be skeptical on, and we've only just touched a little bit, some of the more controversial things, but there are so many other things we could talk about as well. But ultimately, like you said, it comes down to every individual patient and deciding whether or not it's appropriate for them, and have a good discussion whenever possible about risks, benefits, potential complications, and alternatives. So if we can at least discuss these things, I feel like we can really improve our care.
I agree that we need to keep the conversation going, keep encouraging skepticism, and make sure that patients get the best care based on the best evidence.
So Ken, is there anything else you'd like to talk about before we wrap this episode up?
Just congratulations for 100, and I hope to be back at 150, and I'm sure I can come up with 5 more things that we can talk about.
Absolutely. All right, Ken. Well, that leaves us, just like you have a tagline, I have a tagline. So can you go ahead and give us that?
Oh, can I give it? Oh, great. Okay. So you know that I like people to do it in like these really distinctive voices. And also I'm stuck in the 80s. So looking at your tagline, I almost want to do it like Schwarzenegger. So until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.